Thanks, Jill.
So for the next 2 weeks, we're still in lectionary year A, which is the Gospel of Matthew. And then Advent brings us into lectionary year B, which is Mark's Gospel. And then after that, you go into Luke's Gospel. And then you go back to Matthew. Poor John doesn't even get a lectionary year. But it's John's Gospel that I was thinking of this week when I had this reading, because there's this line in John chapter 6 where Jesus is explaining about the bread of life. And the disciples say, "This is a hard teaching. Who can hear this?" And I say that because I read this parable and it gives a description of God that I find very hard to understand. We're very clear in our tradition that Jesus is the revelation of God. He's the ultimate, is God made human, in other words. So if we want to know what does God look like, what does God act like, what does God sound like, we look at Jesus Christ, or gentle Jesus, meek and mild, to give him his full title. This is God who suffers the little children to come to him. This is God who looks upon the poor and the marginalized and the oppressed and is moved to his bowels to help them. He's compelled to help the least. This is God who welcomes the sinner, who feeds the hungry, who gives the thirsty a drink. We're coming into prisons week. This is God who calls us to go to prison and visit the prisoner, to care for all. But in this parable, we get this incredibly different picture of God, someone that doesn't ring true. And there's no doubt in my mind we're dealing with an image of God here, because these three parables that we're looking at over last week, this week, and next week all relate to the kingdom of God. They all relate to God's judgment. And any parable that relates to master and servant in this context clearly relates to God and humanity. Jesus is quite explicit. So the third servant describes God as a hard man who reaps where he has not sown, who profits from investments that he has not made, someone who inspires fear. And when the master is challenged with that, he does not dispute it. The master does not deny any of these allegations, in fact makes clear that the master knows that's how the servant views him, and asks him, "Knowing all those things about me, why then didn't you do something with what I gave you?" And then the master casts his slave out into the outer darkness with the wailing and the gnashing of the teeth. And you're thinking, how does that reconcile with my understanding of who God is as revealed in the person of Jesus? What is there about Jesus that suggests he's hard and inspires fear, that takes what he's not entitled to? Basically, how do we approach this parable understanding our view of God? And that's what I wanted to look at this morning. Now, this is the second of these three parables that deal with the return of Jesus. Last week, it was the parable of the wise and foolish bridesmaids, which taught us that Jesus is going to come back. We just don't know exactly when. And so the best thing we can do is be prepared for that, and we're prepared by living a kingdom life. Next week, it's the judgment of nations, where we look at the criteria that God applies when we come to face our own judgment. And this week, it's what we call the parable of the talents. And it's a fairly straightforward one. Very common, a master going away in business would leave his servants or his slaves in the hand with his affairs and would instruct the servants or slaves to carry on the master's business while they were away. What is unusual is the amount of money here. So a talent of gold, I'm told, is around about 33 kilograms, and I haven't checked today, but that's around about 1.2 million pounds. Okay. Now, that doesn't sound a lot to our ears. I think my last gas bill was round about that region. And in fact, if you're good at kicking a football, you earn that a week. But back then, this is a huge sum of money. This is like an inconceivable amount of money. So we're already in this tension in the story about why this master is entrusting such ludicrously large sums of money to his servants. If the master is, as the third servant describes them, harsh, cruel, and overbearing, then we might wonder, is the master actually setting up these servants to fail, deliberately giving them stupidly large sums of money, knowing that there's nothing that they can do? So one's given five, one's given two, and one's given one, and the first two servants put the money to work and double what they're given. The third one hides it in the ground, and you think, well, that's really odd, but that's how we dealt with things in those days. The safest place very often to keep your money was hidden away. We're still finding sums of money that people have buried underground for safekeeping, so there's nothing unusual in what he's done. The master returns and says, "What did you do with what I gave you?"
The word the Bible uses here is accounting. And the only time we see that word in Matthew's gospel previously is in the parable of the unforgiving servant, where the large, unimaginably large debt was forgiven by the master, who then the servant went on and didn't forgive the relatively minor one. So first thing I need to tell you is there's no distinction between the first two, even though one has made far more money for the master than the other. One hands over 10, the second one hands over 4. So there's 6 talents difference here. That's a huge sum of money, but there's no difference between them. What matters to the master is they have taken what they've been given and they've used it for the master's benefit while the master has been away. They've been productive. The parable concerns this third servant who buried the money and then handed it back unused, untouched, unsullied, unrisked. And we have sympathy with this man because we can understand if the master is as bad as the third servant says he is, why should he risk the wrath of the master? Why should he risk being punished and making a mistake and messing up and destroying what the master gave him? He's preserved it. He's protected it. He's kept it safe, and he's now handing it back to the master. We know from all the adverts we watch on TV, the value of investments can go down as well as up. All this man has done is seek to conserve and preserve what he's given so he can return it to the master untouched and unsullied. And yet he's taken and cast out into the outer darkness, and what was given to him is given to the first servant. So what is the issue here? What is the teaching that Jesus wants to take from it? Well, for me, it's this. It's a question of attitude. It's a question of the third servant's opinion of the master that's key to this. His motivation for not doing anything what he's given is fear of the master. He doesn't put what he was given to work for the master because he's afraid. He fears the cruelty, and he uses that as his justification for not doing anything with what he was given. He's scared. He doesn't love the master, in other words. And this is his excuse for sitting on what he was given. I was afraid of you. I was worried that I would do the wrong thing, and so I kept it. That's his view of God. And some people share that view. Some people see God as a vindictive and cruel entity, simply looking for us to slip up so we can be punished and cast into the outer darkness with the gnashing of the teeth. And if that is your view of God, little wonder then you don't do anything with what God has given you. We think God has called us to live in this way. And we looked at this in the Sermon on the Mount, how we're supposed to live as Christians. And you look at that life and you think, that is just impossible. We're being set up to fail. We've been given this impossible task. We have this cruel and hard, vindictive master who will crush us when we mess up, and we are going to mess up because we can't do this. That is our opinion of God. So we hoard what we have. We hoard what God has given us because we're too afraid to risk it in case we incur God's wrath. And we use the fear of God as an excuse for not doing anything. And I think it's this perception of God that makes this part of this ongoing series of judgments on the leadership of Israel. God had called Israel to be the light of the nations, and God had blessed them and gave them the law by which they were meant to live and be known as God's people and witness to who God was to the surrounding nations. And some of them have loved God and have taken this message seriously and have proclaimed God to the nations. And so with Jesus present in the world at this time, we can then identify the disciples are these first two servants. They have taken what God has given them, they have gone out, and they are preaching the world. Remember, Matthew's been written some 20, 30 years after the death of Jesus. So we have this period of the early church going out. They've gone into the world, they've proclaimed God's love, and the kingdom belongs to them. The leadership of Israel are the third servant who've sought to protect what they had received from Moses, what God gave to Moses. They've sought to protect it and keep it free from contamination or sin, and they've wrapped up the regulations and they've preserved them and they've buried it under all their own laws. They've not acted out of a love for God, but of a fear for God. This is what God is calling us to do. Oh my goodness, it's so awful. Let's have all these regulations. Let's conserve and protect and put up barriers around Israel from everyone else so that we can be who God has called us to be, pristine, unsullied, untouched by the world. They've been too afraid, so they kept the message of God's salvation secret and safe to themselves. And that's the interpretation that certainly fits the culture and the scenario in this reading. But there's also a feeling that this passage relates to the period the disciples are now living in, which is the period we're living in, between the emergence of the kingdom and its final culmination. The time between Jesus leaving the world at the ascension and returning in glory. The resurrection and returning in glory. So it's a warning. We've just been warned Jesus has left, but is coming back at some point. We don't know when. And we know that we will have to give an accounting to Jesus for how we have spent our time with the gifts we have been given. And I think this parable, like last week, is told to warn us. We're looking at the traits disciples are meant to possess. Last week it's readiness. This week it's productiveness. We're not meant to spend our lives idly waiting for the return of Jesus, conserving what we have, protecting it. We're meant to go out into the world, entrusted on our master's business, to go and proclaim the good news that God loves us, has not forgotten us, and longs for us to be returned into this relationship with God. We are called to be productive. Now, this brings anxiety, because are we going to be adjudged on what we have achieved? Isn't this faith by works? And if we know one thing about the Reformed faith, it's this: we are not saved by works. So what is this thing? Well, the fact is, there's no distinction between the first two disciples. It doesn't matter. It's their attitude that's praised. It doesn't matter one made five and one made two. It's the fact that they took what the master gave them and went out into the world and used what the master had given them for the master's benefit. They weren't passive. They put their talents to work because they loved the master and wanted to see the master's business flourish. They did something. They were motivated by love and desire to see the master's business grow. And that's what's being praised. They knew they had been entrusted with something special by a master who has faith in them. And they wanted to serve that master, not themselves. They're not motivated by fear. They want the best. Contrast that with this third servant, who is passive, who takes no steps to use anything he's been entrusted with, doesn't even do the basic thing of putting it in a bank to earn some interest, doesn't give it to someone else and get them to do the work for them. He just hides it, preserves it, so it can just be returned to the master completely untouched and unused. There you go, Lord. This is what you gave me. I've looked after it. I've kept it safe from all things. Here you go. I think this is because he sees the master as the hard man, and he's afraid. So I don't want to risk failing. I don't want to risk taking what you're giving me and failing it. I'm just going to never bother in the first place. And I think that is the issue. How do we see God? If we see God as a tyrannical bully longing to punish us, then we will be that third servant because we will be terrified to risk what we've been given in case we stuff it up. But if we see God as giving us this opportunity to partner in this mission, we're going to be more inclined to go out there because we love God and we want to see God's kingdom grow, and we'll use what God has given us for the master's glory. Now, it doesn't just apply to us as individuals, it applies to us as the church, collectively. Do we think what we have in terms of church is something that we need to preserve and conserve and protect, keep it locked up, keep it hidden away from the world? Because we might do something, it might not work, and then we'll upset God, and then we're all in trouble. And there are churches that take this view, who see the mission of the church as simply to exist, to continue. And so they corral their resources, and they take every opportunity to preserve and amass, so they can just keep going as church. The problem is, being closed off like that, being insulated from the world, is you're never going to grow, because inflation and aging will take their toll. And soon what they were left with, what they have been so keen to preserve and amass, becomes worth less and less and less every year until it ceases to exist. If the church is only existing for its own sake, then it will come to that end. If you view God as someone who needs to be placated, you will come to this end. Some churches take the opposite view. They think, well, God's given us these resources, these talents, these people, this mission. We know God is love, we love God, we think God's mission is important, so let's use what God's given us to grow God's kingdom. And they invest, they go out into the world, and they put their talents to work, showing people what God's love actually looks like in practice. They live as disciples, they make disciples, they take risks for the sake of the gospel. For me, it's more a question of this. People talk about the church dying. I think the church is failing to carry out its core business, which is proclaiming God, making growing disciples, teaching the word, witnessing the faith, meeting human need through loving service. However you want to phrase it, it's about going out and being God to those around us, taking what God has entrusted us and using the gifts and the talents God has given us and putting them to work for God. That's the first and the second servant. And you can look at what we're doing here, and you can look at the Connections Cafe, you can look at the parish nursing, you can look at the hot chocolate, you can look at the house groups, the friendship groups, the days out, the thing you did in the summer, the activities on a Sunday. All these things to go out and to use what we have to grow the kingdom. We're looking at this new presbytery structure with the changes that that's brought about, and we're wondering, what on earth does this mean for us? This new stage in the church's mission here in the Presbytery of Perth, what does it look like for us? Well, it looks like the same. We've been given talents, we've been given gifts and graces, and we then have to use them for God's glory. Nothing has changed. We take what the Master has loaned to us and use it for the Master's benefit. That's really all that's happening. So are we risk takers? Are we taking risks with what's been given because we love God and we want God's kingdom to grow? Or are we afraid of failure and the consequences that we think God will visit upon us? All right, third question here comes into stewardship. Don't we have an obligation to be good stewards of what we've been given? Can we really take risks if it's not going to lead to anything productive? Well, of course we have to be careful. But it doesn't mean burying it. That's not good stewardship. It doesn't mean protecting it and preserving it and keeping it safe from the world. That's not stewardship. God has given us minds and we're meant to use them. We're meant to discern the call of the community around us and meet that need through loving service. That's what we are called to do. We are to put what we have to work for God, and we're shown it doesn't matter if we make 5 talents, it doesn't matter if we make 2 talents, it doesn't matter if we just make basic interest. That's not the point. The point is do something rather than just conserve ourselves and wait for the inevitable end. God's called us to be the church. God's given us talents. God's given us resources. The call is now on us to use that for God's glory. And if it goes wrong, it goes wrong. But at least we tried, and that seems to be the most important thing. There's an American monk called Thomas Merton who has a wonderful prayer. And part of his prayer is this: the fact that I think I am following your will does not mean I am actually doing so. But I believe the desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope I have that desire in all that I am doing. Trying to please God is as good as pleasing God. But it comes down to our attitude. How do we see God? Do we see God as a tyrannical bully, or do we see God as love? What do we do with what we are given? It's not a test, Christianity. It's not a test that we can pass or fail by what we do. It's an attitude. It's a relationship of love between the Creator and the created. So friends, my prayer for you is this: might we always see God as a loving Creator whose plan is to see God's kingdom fully emerge on the earth. Might we see what we have received as a gift from God to be used for God. And might we work daily to invest what God has graced each one of us with, individually and collectively. Might we promote God's kingdom, investing what we have given in this wonderful future we know is to come to all whom we meet. Might we take risks for the sake of our gospel. Amen.